From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we continue our look at clean energy with a discussion of the economics of green. Later, why some say the closure of a Wisconsin nuclear plant isn't a victory for clean energy.
I think it's important that people understand that by shutting down Kewaunee, there will be more use of coal to produce electricity in Wisconsin. And that's the trade-off that we're really talking about environmentally.
A Wisconsin researcher works on a potentially game-changing solar device.
This is not about, you know, fundamentally changing the solar energy industry. It's adding more capabilities, adding more functionalities to it.
And arts meets activism. We'll meet a Fox Valley musician fighting against wind farms. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. This week on Lake Effect, we're talking about the promise and the realities of clean energy during our Project Milwaukee series, Power Switch. Earlier this week, we spoke with Todd Myers, the environmental director of a Washington State free market think tank. Myers contends that the free market, not government, should determine which sources of clean energy flourish in this country. Our next guest believes private industry plays a crucial role, but that public involvement is equally important. Dr. Abdur Choudhury says public-private partnerships should be the key factors at the heart of the clean energy equation. Choudhury is chairman of the economics department at Marquette University and a Lake Effect contributor. He tells Bonnie North more about the factors that he believes will determine how Wisconsin proceeds.
There are a couple of things that will impact the green energy production in the Wisconsin. Obviously, consumer demand and taste would be a very important factor. And also business firms that are operating here, how they decide their, you know, the bottom line, their profit margin, that will also have some impact. Government policies towards green energy, you know, having some government fund to leverage private funds, that will be an important factor. So I think these are a couple of factors that will have an impact.
Now, when you talk about the government policies, are there any in place already that have already affected green energy here?
There has been some policies in effect, especially during the Doyle administration. They started a number of programs. For example, the workforce development in the department in Madison, they have a program with the community college and technical colleges where they're trying to prepare and train workers for the green energy related firms, because that's one thing we do need. We do need workers that are skilled in areas which are in demand in the green energy. So that was a program that was started. Then we do have a number of other programs. For example, in the North Wisconsin, we have a program which basically is about participated by about 18 counties. And what they have done is they have tried to encourage green production over there, green economy-related production. So there are some programs in place.
Are any of these factors, these economic factors, different here in Wisconsin than we might see around the rest of the country when it comes to green energy?
There is some difference, obviously, because it depends on the ground condition, and it can vary from one state to another. I would say the main factors would be similar across the board. However, one thing that we have seen is that different states have taken different approaches towards green energy, and in fact, if we look at the Midwest states, Wisconsin is a little bit behind compared to, let's say, Minnesota. Minnesota is far ahead in terms of utilizing green energy, encouraging green energy production. So we have a little bit of catching up to do in that regard.
So what do you think is standing in the way of making those steps here in Wisconsin?
I would say the main factor here is now we do need some effective steps from the government to motivate private sectors. And another thing that we have is the lack of enough skilled workers in this area. So this is where I think there's a need for public-private partnership.
Well, how much of this can be mandated, do you think, though? I mean, can the government force this on to private industry?
No, I don't think it can be forced on the private industry. The government can encourage various steps and you know, they can create an environment where the private industry can come in. But I don't think mandating these things would take us too far.
So do you think it needs to be consumer-driven, that
I would
consumer
think
demand
so.
Is
yes.
going to make that economic difference?
Yes, I really think so, that once the business firms feel that consumers are gradually moving in that direction, they will have no other choice but to adapt to these green energy-related production.
Do you think that's the tipping point, that that's where producers are going to say, okay, now we have to start incorporating?
Yes, I think so. Producers will respond to what the market is telling them. And once we get a signal from the consumers that that's the way they want to move, I think the producers have no other choice but to respond.
Do you think, though, that there might be some push from the producers themselves that could influence consumer demand? You know, that it can go the other way?
Obviously, you know, there are areas where the producers can create a sort of a perception that will help to sort of, you know, make up the some consumers will make up their mind. Yeah, I think that can play a role too.
When it comes to energy, you know, most people are always talking about costs. How rational are the factors that influence cost of energy? And is it likely those same factors are going to influence green energy as they do the current type of energy, say petroleum or nuclear or hydro?
Obviously, cost will be a factor. In some cases, you'll see the cost may be a little bit higher for green energy-related production. However, in the long run, I think the costs will pay off, even though in the short run, you will see a little bit high cost. But in the long run, once you know the returns start to come in, both in terms of the profit level of production firms and also socially beneficial returns come in, I think in the long run, it will work out and then it'll be more attractive.
Do you think that one of the impediments to adopting green energy has been that profitability factor, that energy producers haven't seen how to make a profit yet?
Yes, I think so, especially in the short run. Energy producers, or for that matter, any producer, basically look at the bottom line in the short run. And in the short run, they do see an increase in cost. But one thing they don't consider or they don't take into the equation is that after a certain period of time, the return will exceed the costs. And in the long run, it will be beneficial, not only for individual producers, but also for the society as a whole, where producers are also consumers for other products.
Thinking about, again, economies of scale and the kind of green energy production that's out there now, a lot of them aren't available on a large scale yet because the energy and research hasn't gone into figuring out how to make them larger. And then some aren't even viable yet. What do you think is going to make producers make the investment into figuring these things out? Is it going to, we're coming back to consumer demand again, is it going to be consumer demand, or is it going to be coal is running out, oil is running out, we have to think of something else?
Yes. If you look at the trend nationally and also in Wisconsin, we have seen some change in producers' perception of where they want to go. So they are also thinking in terms of, you know, how long can they use all these existing energy sources and whether they have to look into alternative sources of energy for the future. So there is some realization not only among the consumers, but also among some producers. So we can only expect that, you know, this will spread among other producers and they will, you know, they will understand that, you know, we do have to start thinking about green energy sooner rather than later.
Does it make more sense economically then to put our eggs in one or two baskets of green energy, or would it make sense for people to explore whatever's out there and then see what rises to the top?
I think it would be better to explore whatever is out there, because in terms of competitive advantage, it may vary from, example, one state to another. We may be better in energy efficiency. Another state may be better in wind area. So I think we have to look at all the options and then see what works best for us.
So where do you see green energy, both production and consumption of it in the state, going in the next 5 or 10 years?
I do see the potential for a significant increase in green energy use, green energy production. Currently, if you look at Wisconsin, if you look at the labor force, less than 1% of our labor force works in the green energy related area, whereas we do have potential to increase that employment. And so I think I do see a lot of potential, but we have to sort of seize the opportunity. Government, private, partnership, I think will take us ahead in this area.
I'm interested in the fact that you keep coming back to the labor force, and that is such a key component to any of these discussions that we don't seem to talk about very much. What is it going to take to get that labor force in place in order to be able to realize, any kind of green energy production?
One thing I think is in this area, the community colleges, the technical college in Wisconsin can play an important role. They can sort of prepare the workforce so that they can participate in the green energy related production. So I think having a planned program where we can produce skilled labor who can work in these green energy related areas, I think that would be beneficial.
In terms of percentage of workers in the next 5 or 10 years, how much do you think it might rise, having that trained workforce?
Nationally, also, it's somewhere around 1%, not much higher. So I think there is potential, but I don't see it increasing significantly. If we can have 2%, 3% of our labor force in that area, I think that in the next 5 years, I think that would help us a lot. That would be a big achievement.
We'd be doing very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Chaudhry, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, thank you for having me here again. Thank you.
Dr. Abdur Chaudhry is chairman of the economics department at Marquette University and serves on the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago's Academic Advisory Council. He spoke with Bonnie North for our Project Milwaukee series, Power Switch. We'll take a break now, and when we return, one Wisconsin researcher talks about where he believes nuclear power should fit in the clean energy puzzle. Project Milwaukee Power Switch continues when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. We're talking this week about clean energy during our series Project Milwaukee Power Switch. And for the rest of today's show, we're going to get varying takes from some Wisconsinites on different forms of energy. The doomsday clock measures the likelihood the world will end from nuclear war, global warming, or biosecurity problems. So it might be ironic that many climate scientists think a key to protecting the planet is nuclear energy. It's a dichotomy that is getting a hard look from at least one Wisconsin researcher. Dr. Paul Wilson is a professor in UW-Madison's Engineering Physics Department. He's also chair of the Energy Analysis and Policy Program of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. He spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley about how he believes going green might mean going nuclear.
Nuclear power is very close to being a sustainable energy source already, and certainly we understand how to make it much more sustainable. And there's lots of aspects when we look at what is considered a sustainable energy source. Certainly on the input side, nuclear energy does consume a resource that is not infinite. So there's some finite amount of time that we can do that. And on the output side, there's the question of the long-term environmental impact. And I think here, nuclear is already quite sustainable.
What are the pros and cons of keeping nuclear power in the energy equation?
The biggest benefit of nuclear energy is its very reliable source of low-emission electricity generation. If we look today in the United States, nuclear energy provides about 70% of our low-emission electricity already. So we're really relying on nuclear energy as a workhorse for giving us access to electricity without adding emissions to the atmosphere.
And you talked about reliability and that it's more reliable than, say, the wind or the sun. How is that important, given that those things do exist and are sustainable?
If we want to compare nuclear energy to wind and solar, I think that many nuclear engineers would agree that we need to have a combination of those things. So I think that we need to look at where they all fit into the energy equation. Wind has a lot of benefits. It's certainly getting cheaper and cheaper all the time. And in certain regions in this country, it's a very viable energy source. But as you just suggested, wind doesn't blow all the time. And so we need to make sure we have a way to provide reliable energy. If you look at the state of Wisconsin, something like 40% of the hours of the year, we have this minimum amount of electricity we need to be providing all the time. And nuclear energy has demonstrated that it can be there all the time. We have to refuel the plants, but even with that refueling, nuclear energy power plants tend to be available over 90% of the time. And if we schedule those refuelings properly, then we can really rely on it to be a what we call base load and really stable part of our energy mix.
Why do some climate scientists seem to prefer nuclear waste over carbon emissions from fossil fuels?
I think that's an easy one. Nuclear waste is really a very easy problem to deal with, despite what most people think. I like to talk about the three C's of spent nuclear fuel. The first one is that it's compact. If we look at spent nuclear fuel and how much of it we produce, even if we were to get all of our electricity for our entire lifetime out of nuclear energy, and that's five times as much as we typically get in the United States, then it would still only be a lifetime burden for each person of about one soda can's worth of nuclear fuel. So it's very compact. All the nuclear fuel ever generated in the United States could fit inside a typical football stadium about 15 feet high. So the compactness is the number one thing. The second is that it's contained. And so unlike emissions to the atmosphere, which quickly spread and are very difficult to deal with once you've emitted them, spent nuclear fuel is a solid. We know exactly where it is because it comes out of the reactor and we can track it. And so it's contained in the fuel itself is a solid. It's wrapped in a metal lining. That's also a solid. We put that into either spent fuel pools for the short term or right now for longer term into dry storage, which are also sealed metal canisters. And so that contained nature is very important. And the final one is that it's cared for. And so we have decades now of experience of managing actively spent nuclear fuel. Unlike other pollution sources from the energy business, we have been tracking every single piece of spent nuclear fuel ever taken out of a reactor, and we know where it is today. And finally, we've been paying for it. The Nuclear Waste Fund, established in 1982, means that every time we produce electricity from a nuclear power plant, we're contributing to a fund that will pay for the ultimate disposal of that spent nuclear fuel. And so from that perspective, I think spent nuclear fuel is something that we have a very good handle on as a pollutant compared to emissions into the atmosphere.
How rational is fear then that nuclear waste will somehow get out of storage and cause harm to the environment or to us as humans?
People have a lot of different fears around nuclear energy, and it's not fair to talk about whether they're rational or not rational. I think the question really is helping people understand the benefits and the risks of nuclear energy and letting them arrive at their own position. I would be very happy to live close to a nuclear power plant. I think the risk of any radioactive pollutants reaching me and my family would be very low from the understanding I have of those risks. And so I think that being able to better compare what the different risks are from different energy sources and understanding what the benefits are is, and helping people find a context in their own lives for what those things are is really the answer to that question.
I guess you were kind of just talking about this. Some climate scientists say they fear global warming more than a nuclear meltdown living next to that power plant, and some say even more than a nuclear bomb, but the doomsday clock accounts for both. So which should scare us more and why?
So I think the news this week from Japan is that the best assessment by global health professionals is that the radiological consequences of what happened in Fukushima are virtually zero, and the largest health consequences that have come from that have been the stress caused by evacuations and the social response to that accident following that tsunami. So what we know about the risks of global climate change are that even if the probability is modest, which some people believe, I believe it's quite large, even if the probability is modest, the extent of the consequences is so vast, eliminating some countries from existence, miles of coastline that may become uninhabitable, that I think if you put those things on a balance, the risk of global climate change is a much larger threat to our way of life than a nuclear power plant is.
What about intentional misuse of nuclear power? Could terrorists cause a nuclear power plant to melt down, or could a country like Iran hide a nuclear weapons program under the guise of an energy initiative?
So those are two very different questions. Let's take them one at a time because they have very different answers. From the point of view of sabotage of a nuclear power plant in a country like the United States, the risk of that is really very low. The technology that's in place, the way that these reactors actually behave, it would be very difficult to actually successfully misuse the civilian nuclear power system in the United States as an act of terrorism, at least in terms of having a real public health consequence. Certainly, what terrorists are often interested in is the psychological impact. And so that's a different story. But there's a lot of targets in the United States that could cause much bigger real harm and much an equivalent psychological impact to attacking a nuclear power station. Following 9/11, nuclear power plants were given one of the best grades of all of our infrastructure in terms of being prepared for and hardened against that kind of threat. Turning to your question about Iran and of course, North Korea as well, that's a very different issue. And technology at this point is really not going to be something that allows us to change that. I used to believe in seeking technological solutions to that question, but I've come to learn diplomatic solutions are where we need to focus our effort. The technology to do this, what Iran is doing, is really technology that's already available. And so trying to protect or hide that is not a viable path forward. What we need to do is change the diplomatic equation so countries like Iran don't feel an incentive to pursue a weapons program and are interested in behaving according to the norms of international society, which state that we will not follow weapons programs if we're new countries like that.
Can you explain the progressive generations of nuclear reactors and what they mean for the environment?
A few years ago, this concept of generations of nuclear reactor was introduced. It was actually largely introduced to aim at what the future generations would be, and those are classified as generation four. So then that sort of created this need to number the generations working backwards. So the first generation reactors came online in the late 50s, early 60s, and these were largely reactors brought onshore from the naval reactor program. And there's only a handful of those, and none of them are operating anymore. It was the first time we used nuclear energy to produce electricity in our grid. The second generation reactors are the vast majority of those reactors we have here in the United States. In fact, all of the operating reactors would be considered part of the second generation of reactors. And most of the world's reactors are in the second generation. The third generation of reactors are the ones being built today. The ones being built today, there's four in the United States under construction. There's one in Finland, a handful in the Pacific Rim, in China and Japan and so on. And those reactors have what we call passive safety features or advanced safety features that require human intervention much less to maintain the safe behavior of the reactor. And so whereas the Generation 2 reactors over time have been improved and improved and are already very safe, they require humans to be opening valves and pushing buttons and monitoring reactors if they go into sort of unusual circumstances. The Generation 3 reactors have advanced systems that rely on natural forces like gravity and pressure to keep these reactors in a safe condition for many days if something were to go wrong and allow humans a much longer time to figure out how to respond.
Is it true researchers are looking for a way to use nuclear waste itself as a source of power? And would that make nuclear energy completely sustainable?
So this is the major path towards increased sustainability. I think there's no way to make it completely sustainable, and I guess we could have a different discussion about what that term actually means. But nuclear energy could become much more sustainable if we were recycling spent nuclear fuel. It's an interesting irony from my point of view that with so many things that we're interested in recycling in our society, this is the one thing that would actually have huge energy value that for some reason we can't, mostly from a political point of view, can't move ourselves forward to do so. For a little bit extra cost, what we'd be allowed to do is take spent nuclear fuel, separate it into three different parts. Most of it is the same uranium we put in the reactor in the first place. Then there's some of it, a small fraction of it, that's lighter than that uranium, and that ultimately would still be waste, and we'd have to dispose of that somewhere, but it's a small fraction. And another small fraction, which is stuff heavier than uranium. And all those parts that are heavier than uranium could be put into special purpose reactors and used to produce electricity, converting it into that lighter than uranium stuff and removing some of that problem. The heavier than uranium part is the part that really causes us the most challenge in terms of dealing with spent nuclear fuel in the long term. So if we could not only get energy out of it, but convert it to that lighter than uranium fission products, then it would make both the waste disposal issue much simpler and we get a lot more energy out of it.
What are the implications of two of Wisconsin's nuclear power plants closing due to financial concerns?
So we have four reactors originally in Wisconsin. The La Crosse boiling water reactor closed some time ago. Recently, Kewaunee has closed, and that leaves two reactors at Point Beach open. I think this is actually a very interesting and very upsetting, to me, state of affairs, and it's driven largely by the low price of natural gas today. But what it indicates to me, more importantly, is really a lack of leadership within the state to recognize the value of nuclear energy for many different aspects. We have a few hundred high-paying jobs that will no longer be in the state, and we know that's of great political interest right now. We have a really lack of leadership in energy policy. And while it's economically expedient today to be shutting down Kewaunee in favor of cheap natural gas, I think that in the long term, the environmental consequences of that transition, which will result in more use of coal in the state of Wisconsin, I think it's important that people understand that by shutting down Kewaunee, there will be more use of coal to produce electricity in Wisconsin. And that's the trade-off that we're really talking about environmentally. And finally, natural gas prices will go up again. We may not have Kewaunee available to us. That's been responsible for about 40 years of providing very inexpensive electricity to the state of Wisconsin.
So to summarize your position, why do you think going green means, at least in part, going nuclear?
So I think nuclear is an important part of a green electricity future because it has a low emission source of electricity, and the waste products that it produces are compact, contained, and cared for. And so it provides us a path towards a much more sustainable electricity future.
Dr. Paul Wilson, thank you for being on Lake Effect and for being a part of our Project Milwaukee series.
Thank you very much for letting me participate.
Paul Wilson teaches engineering physics at UW-Madison. He's also chair of the Energy Analysis and Policy Program of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. As part of our Project Milwaukee Power Switch series, he talked with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley about nuclear energy's sustainability. You can hear the whole series at WUWM.com. Keep listening. A Wisconsin engineer tries to effect big change in the solar energy paradigm. We'll hear more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. As we've heard on our Project Milwaukee series this week, Wisconsin utilities are required to generate 10% of their electrical power by renewable sources such as biomass, wind, and solar. That last source has been harnessed for decades, but only recently have its costs come down enough to make widespread use more appealing. The technology has also improved so that states outside the Sun Belt, such as Wisconsin, can capture and use solar power. But a problem in these less sunny states has always been in storage, so that solar power's delivery is uninterrupted, even on a cloudy day. Enter Hongrui Zhang, a scientist at UW-Madison. Zhang says he took a page from science fiction in approaching that challenge and has worked out a micro-scale design that balances solar energy harvesting, storage, and usage. But the device has far wider applications than what it was originally developed for. Speaking by Skype from Madison, Zhang told Lake Effect's Bonnie North about the impetus for his work.
We all know that the green energy has become more and more important. We're looking for a solution that is using the sustainable energy sources. And the solar energy obviously has been long sought because the sun is always going to be there for a long time. But the energy problem mainly has been broken down into two. One is the energy harvesting. So you have the source and how you collect that energy and convert it to electricity that we can all use. And the second part of the problem, which is sometimes overlooked, which is storage. We're all familiar with the batteries, the capacitors that can store the energy for us. But currently, most of the approaches are taking these two solutions into two different routes. So either solve the energy harvesting problem or handling the storage problem itself. More and more applications, we're looking into combining these two together. So it would be highly desirable to have one device that can perform the energy harvesting, the conversion of the solar energy in this case, and the electricity storage at the same time. So that will, in that case, we can get a dual functionality, multi-functionalization, especially important for miniaturization because you can look for smaller form factor devices, which has both functions at the same time.
Has storage of generated solar power been a vexing issue in the past, or was it the combination of these two different things, as you say, the harvesting and the storage in one device that was the issue?
Well, I should look that into a context. For instance, if you have a solar panel on the roof, chances are you also have a battery that will be charged by the electricity. If your solar panel converts the electrons, and those electrons can be put into a power grid as well, can be used for later, and you can probably get some credit for that. But if you're looking at more localized application, for instance, suppose we are talking about a small solar panel for a traffic light, for instance, right? If you can have a more self-sustained systems that can convert energy, store it for night use, that will be more efficient than running the power through the lines. So it's not like there is no solution at all at the moment. It's just like it would be better to be able to store the converted energy right there at the solar panel for later use.
The application that you envision right now, as you say, is on a much smaller scale. It's even micro applications, perhaps.
Right.
Can this be scaled up to something larger?
Oh, definitely. A little bit of history about this project. This project is supported by National Institute of Health. The project is about making a tunable contact lens to correct the presbyopia for senior citizens. Presbyopia is basically farsightedness. And you lose some accommodation power of your eye.
Right. It's when you need reading glasses as you get
correct.
Older.
Correct. Yeah. So if you have a tunable lens, which means basically to compensate or to recover some of the lost accommodation power, that would be great. But for that, what we are envisioning is to make a tunable lens embedded within the contact lens to realize that. But then there's the sticking problem. Where do we get the power energy? Where get the energy? How do we provide the power source? It's not simply like having a little solar panel and then have a little battery in there. We don't have enough space for everything. So this project started with the mindset that, okay, we have to integrate everything together. So it started with the micro scale, but at the same time, it can be able to scale up, obviously. So I do not have any doubt that ultimately can be scaled up to much larger solar panels, the farms, things like that. But there's a caveat, though. If your energy is directly fed into a large power grid, then that's okay because it's going to be utilized, transmitted throughout the whole power grid. But if you're looking at a more localized application, for instance, it's more self-sustained application, then I think this will be ideal.
So the idea with the original study is the contact lens, the tunable contact lens, is that this technology is embedded in the lens itself. So when the user looks at the sun, it charges?
Oh, it doesn't have to be looking to the sun. I mean, we cannot look into the sun directly. We cannot see anything. It's going to be totally blinded. But the idea is that if you have sunlight, for instance, environment in the surroundings, then the light will be able to charge the solar harvesting devices. And at the same time, some of that energy, electricity, will be stored within that device as well. For instance, if you're driving, you're going through a tunnel, then you would not lose the capability of the devices, electronic devices.
I'm just stunned at the idea of being able to, I wear contact lenses, and to be able to wear something like that and have all of that in there, that's just amazing to me.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
It's a little bit sci-fi, but we hope we will make it a reality.
Well, and assuming that it does, and it sounds like it's going to become a reality, and assuming that, you know, we can scale it up to use, as you say, either on a, you know, say a traffic light scale or even perhaps on a grid level scale.
A microgrid or smaller scale grid. For instance, a remote village or along the highway, where sometimes it's very inefficient cost-wise to run the power line just to get access to a small area. So if it happens to be that area to have a lot of sunlight available, then why not use it?
How do you think a device like this might impact the economics of solar power? I mean, would utility companies, larger power producers, be looking to incorporate something like this into their systems?
I sure hope so. I hope the obstacle will be lower. Of course, first of all, what we realize here is a prototype. Scientifically, we show that it's possible. The next thing is that we need to refine it. We need to keep increasing the performance. And then later on, there's going to be engineering issue. We have to make it a large scale, cost effective, manufacturing, those kind of things. And ultimately, I want to emphasize that this is not about, you know, fundamentally changing the solar energy industry. It's adding more capabilities, adding more functionalities to it.
How quickly do you think this could come to market, assuming that you get any obstacles fixed or, you know, problems solved as you refine it?
Well, that's a great question. From a scientific research, it takes a lot, takes some time to get to the market. I think that's always the case. In this case, I think it's going to be about 10 to 15 years. So we need about 5 more years to do the scientific research, more fundamental scientific research, so that we, at least we understand better what kind of a performance limit, how much the energy conversion efficiency we can get, and how much storage can we get. To answer those questions first, obviously, it's very important. Then I think it's going to take about 10 years to go out of the research laboratory to more like an entrepreneurship type of small company, so the technology is mature enough to go to a larger scale. So I would say 10 to 15 years, probably.
Okay, so not immediately, but certainly not decades and decades away.
Right, not that far-fetched, because we are taking advantage of the establishment of a solar energy at this stage. It has been ongoing for a long time, and in the past 5-10 years, we have been seeing a lot of explosion in terms of the development of the solar energy industry and the technology. So we are definitely taking advantage of that fact and what the other people have done so far.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with
it.
And please let us know how things go as you perfect them.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
Hongrai Zhang is the Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UW-Madison. He and his students developed what he describes as a self-sustaining solar power source. Their results were published this month in the journal Advanced Materials. Research is ongoing. He spoke with Bonnie North. One last break, and then we'll talk music and anti-wind power activism with a Wisconsin woman with feet in both worlds. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
We once no step we missed.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. That is the voice of our next guest, perhaps an unlikely addition to our Project Milwaukee series on clean energy. We've talked about a lot of different angles to the equation this week. We've talked politics, economics, and technology. What we haven't gotten into is the arts angle. Actually, the worlds of energy and music within the life of Jamie Lynn Fletcher are pretty distinct, but she adds a unique dimension to our series. Fletcher is a musician who lives in Wisconsin's Fox Valley, but when she's not playing music, she's working in opposition to large-scale wind farms, pointing to health concerns of hers and others who live near wind turbines. Many public health researchers have evaluated the reports of health maladies related to wind turbines and found scientific evidence lacking, but Fletcher says the effects are very real. Fletcher joined us in the studio for a joint interview. I spoke with her mainly about her music. Environmental reporter Susan Bentz talked with her about wind power. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
This is a smoky voice, smoky sound you have crafted. How did your voice develop? And not just your singing voice, but,
right,
you know, the voice you are as a musician.
Well, this is – it's interesting. I didn't start singing publicly until 4.5 years ago, actually. I tried my hand at it about 13 years ago in this little jazz ensemble at UW-Madison, and – got a bit of interest, but I was terrified. I was still scared to death, and it was nothing I was ever going to do because everybody wanted to be a singer. But shortly after that, I went in, got a master's in broadcast journalism, and one of the strong points they picked out was the voice, essentially. As a kid, this is interesting, we didn't have a lot of female or chick singers in the house as far as music was concerned. Dad really loved the Ink Spots and, you know, the Mills Brothers, Frank Sinatra, so it was very male-oriented. And Mom loved Elvis and Tony Bennett and all of that. So if I ever did sing along secretly to anything, and I had a huge crush on Bing Crosby when I was a kid. Did she actually admit that?
Wow.
I thought Bing Crosby was absolutely great as a singer. And so I just, the ear kind of bent to that sound. And both of my parents have lower voices. So that's just naturally what happened. And when I decided to open my mouth 4 years ago, after my father had passed away, and it was just, it was a progression of writing some songs and writing a song for Dad and needing to get it out, needing to get this other form of expression out that I couldn't get out very well elsewhere, you know, just on piano or playing trombone. And it was mostly just overcoming the fear. And I tried a little bit here and there and actually recorded the first songs I started writing. I didn't have a singer at my fingertips, so I had to do it myself. And it was just so nerve-wracking. And, you know, the judgment of society is just intense. We've got American Idol and all of The Voice, and everybody has become a bit of an expert on singing. So it was a matter of getting over the pressure and just deciding to do it. And then after a bit of practice, a few years, I guess it develops. And it still is developing. I have a long way to go.
Is it easier for you now?
Of course. It's much easier. You know, once you get through the criticism, and of course, I got enormous criticism when I started. I remember I was on a gig in Seoul, Korea at the Grand Hyatt, just doing piano bar lounge stuff, and this very dapper individual came up, and I was doing something. Maybe it was Billy Joel or Johnny Mathis, and he came up and right in my face, and he said, "You're not a singer, are you?" I went, "Wow. Oh. Ouch." And he was a critic for the New York Times, actually. Really, it toughens your skin. You know, and you have to go, well, I want to do this. And it's making enough people happy to know that maybe something is right here. And what's important for me is more the communication, the story of it. And that's, I think, what the last CD is leaning more towards is the story aspect and trying to communicate a story and the emotion in it.
It seems like another whole level of risk, though. You know, you put yourself out there as a singer and you're singing Billy Joel songs.
Right.
And somebody criticizes you, they're criticizing your voice. Mm. But if someone criticized you for this album, they would be criticizing really who you are.
That's right. And I've put it out there for several reviews. It's gotten some great reviews from jazz entities over in Europe. And there was one, though, I sent it to this sort of internet broadcast, the Review Your Music, and they're just sending it out to masses. You know, it could be a group of teenagers. And this is more, it is more of adult music. And I got some scathing, scathing reviews on my voice and the content. And I think, but as I was reviewing some of these reviews, and granted, it's just random listeners. These aren't experts. It's just wherever in the world. Somebody wants, oh, yeah, I like jazz, so let me hear that. But some of the comments, it was funny because I could tell that, for example, the song The Fool, that is clearly about making a very, very severe mistake on my own part, and then waking up and realizing what's going on. But the negative comments, when I was reading them, it was clear that it really hit that person in a way that they didn't want to have to – they could associate it with it, but they didn't want to admit that, and they were upset. And it really – it struck a few chords very severely with some listeners that maybe hit a little too close to home.
Maybe don't shoot the messenger is the proper response.
Yeah, but it is what it is. You know, it's a risk on all occasions. But the skin grows tougher and thicker, and if you want to do it, you've got to be able to get through that. That was a hard lesson, and it will be. You know, endlessly, 20 years from now, with a much smokier, huskier, developed voice, there will always be somebody that you know it might not strike them in the way that they want, and that's
sure.
Okay.
Well, Susan Bentz is our environmental reporter, and this is as good a time as any to segue into the other Jamie Fletcher.
That's right. So what catapulted you into this Wind Energy? Yeah. I realize it's at home. So
it is at
talk
home.
A little bit about how that those projects have impacted your
well,
town.
I was in the gig in Seoul, Korea, the Grand Hyatt Seoul, and I was Skyping Mom, and she said, "Oh, we just got this big packet in the mail from this group, and you know, everybody's all upset about these wind turbines around here, and I don't know what the deal is." And my mom is not so politically active. She's mom, right? And I'll look at it when I get home. And so I got home and didn't think much of it, and finally opened the package, and it was a DVD, and I popped it in, and it was the real life experience of what people were going through in the wind farm in Fond du Lac. And the shadow flicker and the noise and the chickens that were, you know, laying eggs and brooding and hatching chicks with mutated wings and one leg and the animals, the farm animals that were dying. And the stories were just atrocious. I couldn't believe this. What's going on here? Because I was always for wind power, anything that was environmentally clean, of course, wind and solar, all about that. But then all of a sudden, this DVD, it just changed my life. I was like, oh, this is unbelievable. You know, this can't happen. Who would do this to people? This is supposed to be something good. So then began my own study, and I conducted my own interviews with people down in Fond du Lac, and it was horrifying what they were going through in the byproduct of the infrasound or the stray voltage from these turbines. Wisconsin doesn't have any legislation in place to control stray voltage, per se. It's, you know, where California does. And there
was... What's the significance of stray voltage?
There was basically a lot of neutral current or dirty electricity, also electromagnetic frequencies that are, you know, either the turbines, of course, they're electrical generator, and there needs to be a mode of control for extra electricity that is produced. And there really isn't that mode of control, or they might amplify stray voltage as well. There's a lot of issues and just a lot of really, I want to say, poor planning as far as doing this. Number one, it's the area that we're in isn't that – it's not the best on the map for wind, per se. And to do it right in the middle of a rural community, it's been tragic. We've had three families abandon their homes because they can't live there anymore. They were getting sick. We've got over 50 medical affidavits now of people who are experiencing heart palpitations, dizziness, vertigo. They can't sleep, insomnia. You can talk to some and they say, our pillow vibrates all night long. It didn't do this before the turbines. What's going on? They have to go find safety from the infrasound and the vibrations down in their basement because their house reverberates too much.
So you hear from some wind advocates mm-hmm. that these concerns are inflated, that they're, you know, blown out of proportion, mm-hmm. that they're not substantiated.
All the time.
What is your response to that?
It's very interesting. There are certain, you know, sometimes it comes from obviously the corporate entities, and sometimes it comes from just people who it's so hard for them to actually believe that it would do this. And so simply when it comes down to it, anybody who challenges, you know, the notion that these might be harmful in a health manner, I invite them to come up and stay in one of the abandoned homes for a week, stay for a month, stay for a few days. And, you know, we'll monitor you and everything that goes on. We have a fantastic doctor who's been very helpful with all of this in documenting cases. And, you know, if you're that much of a doubter, then come on up and find out for yourselves. And everybody I have, as soon as I bring that up, that sort of, it stops the conversation. It's like, oh, shoot. and that's okay. But people really need to open their eyes as far as what's going on. It's, for example, they're pushing the green and the clean and all of this. But these wind turbines, they've been subsidized for 20 years. They are not competitive. They don't put out the electricity that they should because where they're siting these, the wind is not consistent. Out where we live, the wind is not consistent. So you have to have a backup means of producing energy. If the wind stops or if the turbines shut down or on and off, each time that happens, you have to kickstart on or off a fossil fuel plant, something of conventional means, and that actually puts more pollution into the air by having to turn these on and off all the time as opposed to just running them straight. And so these are things that you don't hear about. They're not sold to the general public that way because it's just sold as clean energy.
Now, do you find within your community, your town mm-hmm. area, that there's a that people agree on this, or do you find varied opinions within your community?
It really depends. The turbine hosts themselves tend not to say anything at all.
By hosts, you mean the people who have allowed these to be built on their land?
It's tricky because then if you have the good neighbor agreement, say it was this at Christmas time, the year before the turbines were to go in, the developers went around and they offered $1,000 to certain people within a certain radius of the turbines to have this good neighbor agreement. And so one is bound by that agreement. You know, they can't say anything then out of legal repercussions. Everybody could use an extra, you know, couple hundred bucks or $1,000 a year. And especially if you're dealing with rural communities, and as you know, rural America and the farmers, it's hard enough as it is. With everything. And so, of course, a little extra money doesn't hurt. So they agree to these things, thinking you're getting this clean energy and you're doing these wonderful things. And then that wasn't the case. So as far as a consensus of agreement, yes, the majority of people in our community agree that there is a problem here. and something really needs to be done because a lot of people are hurting. And it's really tough with the governments, local governments, state governments to look at it. Because there's a certain mandate that by year whatever there needs to be a certain percentage of renewable energy, and it's so tough to break through that mentality and say, okay, let's stop here. You know, let's stop before we go ahead and we hurt other people. There's so much money to be had in this. It's unbelievable.
You know, so in summer, your wind turbine concerns go far beyond the health concerns that you cited
earlier.
Of course,
yeah. I mean, health concerns, it's the most immediate. We've got one of our residents has just found out now she's full of cancer. She didn't have that. And she's been, since the wind turbines went in, she's had heart problems and endless things now, just one on top of another. And now she's got cancer. And, of course, it's very tough to correlate that to, well, is it the stray voltage or do you just have a history of cancer in your family? But now that we have so many cases cropping up of health issues since the turbines went in, these problems did not exist prior to the turbines going in.
Is there let me just ask you this. Is there a such thing in your eyes as wind energy done right?
Absolutely. And this whole thing with energy independence, that's all we hear about, energy independence. But if they really wanted to do energy independence, let's make everybody energy independent on their own right. You can still have your own personal windmill. I'm not talking about an industrial turbine that's 500 feet tall. You can still have your own personal wind power that generates enough for your house, and probably you could sell some back to WPS or whoever the utility is. And if done right and controlled so that there isn't a stray voltage issue or dirty electricity seeping through the ground, I think it could be absolutely fantastic. And if they took these tax subsidies and decided, well, why don't we really make some energy independence and do it on a more individual basis and invest in the individual, invest in the people. This isn't about the goodness of energy and clean energy. This is about the money. And so the money could be utilized much differently.
So have you used music to convey these concerns?
I was going to say there is not a wind turbine song on this album.
Well, not yet. Not yet. I've had so many of my my friends and associates say, you need to do a parody on Blowing in the Wind. it might be coming. I do. Sometimes I just go off on these little rants as I'm sitting at the piano playing a blues song, or maybe I'll just be blues soloing and these obnoxious lyrics are going through my brain about tax subsidization. Jamie, got to come up with something a little more friendly.
Well, Jamie Fletcher, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Jamie Lynn Fletcher is an activist against wind farms and a Wisconsin musician. We're hearing a track from her CD called Jamie. She spoke with me and with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. You can listen to all of our Project Milwaukee coverage at WUWM.com. Tomorrow on the show, Project Milwaukee continues with a look at how clean energy can enter the picture on the individual home level. I'm Mitch Tighe. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.
I keep wishing I were somewhere else, walking down a strange new street, hearing words that I have never heard.